Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Adirondack Podcast. This is actually part two of our podcast. First half aired earlier this week. You can find it on iTunes or listen to it right on adirondack.com. Megan Bard, who's one of our writers, is here, as is Alex Cohen, our producer. I'm Tyler Wilkinson. As always, there will be profanity, so be forewarned. And enjoy the show.
Just real quick, one of the impressive things over the last, not in every game, but over the last few games has been the rebounding margin. Certainly not the Louisville game, but the other games. I mean, in the Memphis game, we rebounded them 32-24.
That made a big difference, really.
Especially with how highly rated their front court is.
And who led the team in rebounds? Who led UConn that game?
We had DeAndre Daniels with 11.
Yeah.
He had a monster game against Memphis.
With Daniels, yeah, he really did.
And then he goes into Louisville and plays like crap.
And then he's had his career high against Temple. I mean, that's the thing with Daniels, and it's very odd because, I mean, he sort of was in the same pattern last year, and he would ebb and flow. He'd have 25 points, then completely disappear. And then, if you remember, late in the year last year, Shabazz got hurt, and Daniels dropped 20 or more in like three straight games. And you were like, well, this is the true ceiling of DeAndre Daniels. You know, if he wanted and he had opportunity, he could score 20-plus points a game. It's been really, really frustrating. I think he's done well, and I want to give him credit because I really do think his attitude is great, especially you talk to him before and after the games. Like, he cares about winning as much as guys like Boatwright and Napier, who are really, really vocal leaders of the team. He takes it hard, especially when they lose.
This is the kind of I'm glad that we have you here because you're the one who sees this before and after the game. Because the average fan, I got to tell you, from me watching games, he just looks more lethargic on the court. He at times looks lost.
And I think that's fair. I think he's a passive guy. Just period. He's a passive guy, yeah. And I think both Ollie and his teammates get on him about that. But I also think, and, you know, it comes and goes, but the team has not been great about putting him in the best position to succeed. And I think there's been times when he's sort of found ways to work around it and where he's rebounded really well. God help him. He's so far out of position playing the four most of these games.
He does not belong at the four.
But he plays hard. I mean, you can't question his effort on defense.
I kind of wonder if that's
our
problem with the paint. Like, when you have these guys and you don't have, like, the Kevin Freeman type, like the big body in the four, because Daniels, I mean, he is a slight guy at his height, and there's nobody there to do the help side defense when he's in, and he's really a shooter in all seriousness, and I sort of wonder, like, you know, yeah, he has these games where he plays amazing, and then he has these games where he doesn't play much at all, and I feel like after last season when he had those great games, his name is getting bandied about with Napier and Boatwright, like, oh, he's an NBA prospect, and then he had a bunch of crap games at the beginning of this year, and he just sort of fell off, and part of me wonders, like, well, he doesn't belong at the four. He's clearly a three guy. He would never play the
especially
four in the
with
NBA.
How good, especially in the NBA. Yeah.
Well, especially with how good his jump shot is. I mean, you know, he's a good outside shooter.
Yeah,
he's so talented. He's so talented. He belongs at the three. And like, but what's our option? You gonna put Olander in at the four?
Yeah, I mean, he's the best NBA prospect on the team. Whether or not that pans out, I mean, I like the kid, but I'd probably bet against it at this point just because of his consistency.
I'll be honest, I like Shabazz more because you spend 30 seconds talking to that kid, and there's a real mind at work there.
Oh, yeah.
And, and maybe this is just my personal bias because I love Shabazz so much, but he's so thoughtful, and he's so intelligent, and he plays like someone who understands the game. I mean, some of these assists he makes, you don't even know how he saw that play developing, and he makes this pass, and you're like,
he's the smartest player I can remember at UConn.
I watch a fair amount of NBA games, and I mean, there's probably five teams out there that he could maybe start on.
Shabazz?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably about five teams.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think the thing with Shabazz is if he lands in the right situation, I think he has a chance to have a very successful NBA career, whether it's in a situation where he can, you know, score 8 to 10 points a game and distribute the ball in Miami. Like, he's projected in that sort of bottom of the first round. It's so all over the place. Some places are in the bottom of the second round.
Yeah.
But I think he's probably going to land in the bottom of the first round if he avoids injury.
He has the tremendous misfortune of being in this draft.
Yes.
And
I mean, he's very small. He's small and he's not very strong. He can shoot. He can shoot the lights out, which is going to help him, especially if you can put him on a team with a big, you know, like a Dwayne Wade at small or a shooting guard and a LeBron.
I mean,
small
he, and forward. He,
yeah. Anybody besides Mario LeBron Chalmers, who is the worst player in the NBA, could play point guard on that team. I could play point guard on
well,
that team.
One thing that's evident on the Heat is that Norris Cole, who's not that great, is a much better option than Chalmers.
But. Yes, yes, and he's not that good. I would. Yes, I would take Shabazz over Norris Cole right now.
Probably.
Here's the thing about Shabazz too. Like I could see him having a perfectly successful NBA career, but I could also see him 15 years down the road being a really great coach.
Me too.
I think he's that kind of player who understands the game in a way that would make him a really outstanding coach.
And he understands sort of the, I don't even, like the politics of basketball and sort of what it takes to get into the.
He does now.
Psychology.
He didn't as a sophomore.
Well,
as a sophomore, he had some miscues and some teammate.
Also, his
teammate
mom is amazing.
Issues.
Love Baz mom. Shout to Baz mom.
Love Baz mom.
Shout to Boat mom too. She's awesome too.
They're both great. But I mean, how much do you love this kid who's like, I told my mom I was going to graduate, and he's going to graduate. And you know, I just feel like that whatever happens, that kid's got a great future in front of him, whether it's the NBA or whatever.
And there's something to be said. I mean, you look at you can be courtside at these games and Donnie Marshall or Jake Vosko walks by and 50% of the arena knows who they are. There's something about UConn that allows you this legacy. I mean, you look behind the bench and there's Talik Brown or... Mm-hmm. The infamous Craig Ostrey, I think, was behind
Rudy
the bench
Gay,
this last
Rudy
game.
Rudy Gay was at the Memphis game.
Yeah. And I mean, like, just being part of that associates you into something bigger. And I think not only is Shabazz very aware of that, he understands. I mean, he won't talk about it because he's very, very humble. You know, intentionally humble. He knows not to talk about
he's
himself.
He's just, he is a bright,
but he's,
bright guy.
He's very aware of his place in UConn history. And the further he leads this team, the further he's going to shoot up those ranks. I think
this season, though, he's already cemented himself as like as one of the more lovable players in UConn history.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny, too, because you watch Shabazz, his freshman year, was probably the best defensive player on the court on that national championship team. He's probably the best defensive player, and you can probably say the same thing again his sophomore year when he was playing with Drummond and Oriaki and Lamb. And then he sort of fell off. And, but, you know, Shabazz has had some injuries the past couple of years, and I've always been wondering, you know, is his, as I feel, at least, his defense has suffered. And by the same token, he's been asked to carry so much more of the load on offense. You know, is he tired? Is he hurt? I think probably the answer is yes to both. You know, I do not think he's healthy, and I don't think he will ever tell you the extent of how much he hurts. But every once in a while, like, the camera will catch him in a grimace that looks like he's going into the operating room.
I mean, here's the thing with tendonitis. It hurts, but it's not debilitating in a way like if you break your ankle, like if you can't cut on it or something. Like, your knee swells up like a cantaloupe, and it sucks, and it hurts, and it doesn't go away unless you stop running around on a hardwood. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's nothing he can do about it short of the compression brace, and I'm sure the trainers are working with him like crazy. And I've noticed a lot recently, Ollie's been taking him out a minute or so before the TV timeouts just to give him a little extra rest.
Yeah,
which,
smart.
So smart. And, I mean, you know, he's apparently got some kind of routine that he's doing. It seems to be helping, but I mean, there's still a lot of season left.
It's an interesting thought though, because you kind of it's only natural to kind of draw a parallel between Shabazz and Kemba. And I guess the question I would ask is Shabazz more or less alone than Kemba was? And because you try not to equate, it's an interesting thought because Lamb was such a talented player on that team. And Oriaki was such a strong presence down low during that season that you wonder maybe Kemba had it a little easier.
Well, I don't think there's any question that 2011 team was better than this team. I will say Shabazz's game is a lot more dependent on the players around him. He's a lot. I mean, Kemba was well-rounded, but Shabazz's entire strength as a player is based around being well-rounded.
Yes.
Yeah,
Kemba could
score.
Kemba could take over
Kemba
the game.
Kemba could score 50 if he had to win a game. I don't know that Shabazz could. I think Shabazz is more likely to score 26, have 9 rebounds and 10 assists and take over a game.
I mean, it's not like you necessarily saw Kemba getting 8-9 rebounds a game, and Shabazz does regularly. And I think this comes back to what we were talking about before about the mind at work there, and a lot of that sort of instinct and being in the right place at the right time. But he gets a lot of long rebounds, and
Well, it's also probably that that as a team, they're focusing so much on rebounding in practice, I'm sure. And considering he's far and away the best player on the team right now, mm-hmm. and most consistent best player on the team. And you can make an argument that Daniels has more physical gifts, but, you know. That only gets you so far. And, I mean, Shabazz is probably the smartest, best player on the team. So it's not really surprising to me that he's taking the rebounding thing to heart and trying to turn his team around that way.
Yeah, and again, like Megan said, he's smart enough to put himself in the right position, which I think is positioning is at least 50% of the rebounding effort, right. While the other half is some combination of effort and strength. And he's definitely got the positioning mm-hmm. down.
I think he's averaging something close to 7 rebounds a game. And the funny thing is, like, some analysts out there are knocking UConn for their leading rebounder being their point guard. But at the same time, it's not like he's averaging 4 rebounds a game. He's averaging 7. So it's not terrible to have your leading rebounder grab 7 boards a game.
Yeah. I mean, they're a bad rebounding team as a general rule, I think. It's obviously not a strength of theirs.
It's getting better, though.
It is. And it's definitely seen improvement.
It's not going to, I don't know, it's not detrimental enough that it should prevent them from doing big things.
I mean, I think it's interesting because
they're not that bad.
We're in this.
They're not as bad as they were last year.
No, they're not. And I think we kind of all sort of sometimes forget that this is only Kevin Ellie's second year as a head coach, and he only had 3 years as an assistant coach before this. We had all those years with Calhoun, who's not only was he at UConn for all those years, but he was at Northeastern before that. He coached high school. I mean, he was a veteran head coach before he got to UConn.
Yeah.
And I mean, as much experience as Kevin Ellie has as a player in the NBA, he's still a almost brand new coach. Mm-hmm. And sometimes things are not, you know, you're going to try some stuff and it's not going to work out the way you plan. And as a second year head coach and somebody with virtually no coaching experience coming into this, I mean, I'll say I'm really impressed. I mean, yeah, you see something, you go, okay, you didn't draw that play out the way you wanted. And you should have had a play ready for this situation. You clearly don't right now. But, I mean, you won 20 games last year with nobody on your team. And, yeah, Louisville hurt and that SMU-Houston stretch was terrible. However, I feel like I see more bright spots than dark spots.
Yeah,
I didn't have a second half for that.
I think I agree with you, and I think most of us who watch the game would agree with you. I think for us, the kind of thing that we're all kind of there was comfort in having Calhoun because you knew he could always recruit, he could always coach a game. The thing that stinks right now is that we all so desperately want Kevin Ollie to be as successful. But the reality of it is we don't know how well he's going to be able to recruit, especially being in this conference, in the coming years. We think he's going to do well. We know that he was a big part of Calhoun's recruiting strategy. But we don't know. We just don't know.
Recruiting's not the part I worry about. I'll be honest. I think as far as his strengths go, I think he's the guy that walks into the room and gets the kids to want to come. And when you think about it with, Sam Cassell, I mean, mm-hmm. granted, he played with that guy's dad, and
sure.
You know that doesn't
hurt.
But
the good thing about, I mean, yeah, I guess I can see what you're saying. The thing you look at, like the list of the top 100 recruits, and he has one guy on there, and that's Daniel Hamilton.
Usually, Calhoun didn't have more than one guy on there.
But then you remember that Calhoun kind of took the guys on the cusp of being there.
I mean, Emeka Okafor was not one of the most sought after guys. I think part of that too is just seeing the talent and knowing this is a guy I want on my team.
Okafor also looked like Nolan in his freshman year.
That is true.
I mean, the thing with Calhoun was probably one of the best in game coaches of all time. The 99 championship game against Duke when they were
outclassed,
a masterclass in college basketball coaching. I would challenge anybody on this earth to find a better coached college game than Calhoun coaching that team.
And the fact is,
especially against Krzyzewski.
Mike Krzyzewski.
He's done it a couple times. That said, I don't think there's a coach in this nation that I would choose to lead this specific team in this specific program at this point in time with where UConn athletics is than Kevin Ollie.
Right.
No question.
He is the absolute, it might not work out, but I wouldn't choose anybody else over him right now.
I can't think of a better representative for the University of Connecticut's basketball program than Kevin Ollie.
You know, we just barely out-rebounded Rutgers though. And I think that's why the score was so close. I mean,
I think we got Temple pretty good, though.
Well, Temple.
Temple,
we out-rebounded them 42-19.
That just seems like a joke.
Poor Temple.
You know what's funny is that I mean Temple is only terrible this year. In recent years, they haven't always been. I mean, like, they've made some noise in the tournament. They've done some, you know, some good things, but this year, just...
I have no words. I have no words for Temple. We took the wrong team. We should have had UMass.
Frustrates me so much that UMass is ranked as high as they are because the rest of their schedule is so cupcake.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, you know, a less talented version of that St. Joe's team in 2004 Delonte West and Jameer Nelson, who everyone was, you know, clamoring about them. Then they went to the tournament. They actually made it farther than I thought they were going to, but
yeah.
I think they might have even lost to Duke. Right?
Yeah, but then we won the national championship.
We did win that national championship.
Yes, we did. That tastes good.
Almost as good as, actually, it tastes better than the whiskey, I'm not going to lie.
I have to say, in terms of the AAC, SMU certainly looks like they're a little more for real than maybe we thought when we lost to them.
They have a really, really beautiful place to play basketball there. So
great coach, great fans.
Yeah, Larry Brown knows how to coach the game.
I mean, I'm real happy to see SMU in our conference.
I think they could.
That's a great team.
Them and Memphis will probably, you know, you would think, develop into real long-term rivals as long as SMU can keep building on their success, you know.
Yeah.
If Larry Brown can stay a few more years and pull in the quality of recruits that he's
capable
of.
I mean, it's Larry Brown. I mean, this is a one of the – I mean, he's great coach.
Well, the other thing that I was saying, too, is the – I mean, I didn't know it was against Temple, but – Temple was a game he was not in. Not playing.
His cousin was murdered right before the Louisville game.
Right, and listen, I'm not gonna dump on Bo. I'm just gonna say that the unit that they had on the floor was very effective against Temple.
I don't know how much that means though, because it's.
I want to say there were a lot fewer turnovers. It felt like the offense was clicking more. On the floor, and it might have just been because it was against Temple.
I would say at any point in time, Boatwright and Napier are the best two players on the floor for UConn. But when one of them sits, I'm going to hedge. When Boatwright sits, it does free up UConn's lineup to do some things that it's not able to do with both guys on the floor. Namely, if you get Kroma and Giffey on the floor together, not only is your defense super long, but it also gives you much more size to rebound. UConn's been really getting their ass kicked with long rebounds, especially since they give up so many three-point shots when they miss, and there's a lot of long rebound attempts. So when you can play with a bigger lineup, even when they went, which is kind of a nice change of events from what we've been talking about recently, when they've let Tyler Olander play the four with Amita Brima playing the five, and they can put, you know, a Giffey or a Chroma at the three. You can tell they're using their size a lot better when they get that advantage.
It works so much better. Tyler Olander should never play the five.
I feel bad every time he's asked to.
And the fact is, when he plays the four,
like, ask me to go to Europe and drive on the wrong side of the road. I don't want to do that.
No, and he's a really, I mean, competent is the word I will use. When he's playing at the four, I mean, he's got some decent size, and when he's...
Well, he's never good on offense, no matter what position he's playing. But he's, in my opinion...
On occasion, he hits a shot,
Demonstrably worse, like, in the post with the ball than either Nolan or Brima. He provides much less of everything else to the point where
Brima's come a long way since the beginning of the season.
He can't play with his back to the basket and the ball in his hands.
That's true.
He's aggressive. He's fast. I think he's.
Well, I did watch him put the ball on the floor, and I was like, Brima, no! Don't do that!
Interesting, too. Brima's also has bulked up a little bit since the start of the season.
Yeah, I mean, while he's not the strongest guy on the floor,
he needs to spend a little more time in the South Campus dining hall, that's
absolutely.
For sure.
He's definitely finding out, like, he's using his body better.
No, the official endorsement of this is South Dining Hall.
Shout out to South Dining Hall.
And some DP dough.
Yeah, all right.
So you posted this on Facebook.
Yeah, it was a really...
got me all fired up.
The Twitter aftermath of how dare ESPN put two women in the booth for a game. Like, how dare they?
For a men's basketball game.
For a men's basketball game. The Twitter comments that came out of that. And maybe just Twitter brings out the cartoonishly evil aspects of people's character.
It does.
But... And maybe that's not even really what some of those people feel deep down. I don't know. But at the end of the day, it's what they're putting out there.
It's straight misogyny.
Up misogyny. And it's, like, especially considering the quality of those particular two female
correspondence. I said this on your Facebook page, but in my opinion, Kara Lawson is one of the best analysts in any sport on television.
She's good.
When she
it kills
first,
me because you know Tennessee,
she went to Tennessee, but yeah, and I should good. I want to hate her, but I can't. And I remember watching her when she first started doing it, and she was just doing the halftime stuff, and there'd be some like random former coach sitting next to her who'd say some like just absolute nonsense, and then they'd turn to Kara Lawson, and Kara Lawson would be like, "So here's what you actually need to know." And then the coaches would come out after the half, and they'd talk to the coaches, and you'd think she'd had their locker room mic'd, like. Everything she said was exactly what the coaches were saying. She's so smart. She does her homework, which is just crazy, and knows what she's talking about. And I mean, if you watch
and,
some
and
of
like
these,
so many of the male, so many of the men who cover these games don't do any modicum of research.
They don't even know how to pronounce like, the names
watch,
of the players.
If you
on
watch the
team,
everyday SNY they're announcing horrible. Team that covers these UConn teams,
they can't
you
even
would
pronounce
be at Kara Lawson's
Brimer's
doorstep
win.
With you know.
I want to send her
a
flowers.
A contract. Yeah, some roses. Please, please come to UConn games.
Right.
She's fantastic. And it's just, and the what gets me is it's not like this is bad officiating. It's women, or not officiating, but commentating. It's women commentating. And that's a problem because it's men's sports. And if you think about, like, you watch women's games, there's men doing the commentating all the time. And yeah. Nobody bats an eye.
Here's the interesting thing, too. I almost think it would be better with smart women calling these games because the women's game is such a smarter game than the men's game. I mean, the men's game relies so much more on just like, you know, raw athleticism, and the women's game is more of a thinking person's game where, you know, you set up plays and you kind of have this strategy going back and forth. Women almost make better, they would almost make better analysts for that kind of thing.
I mean, you take Kara Lawson in particular, who studied under Pat Summitt, who, I mean, she's not my favorite, but Pat Summitt knows her shit. And Kara Lawson won 2 national championships.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I haven't looked at Wikipedia, but she won at least 1 national championship as the point guard for Tennessee. This is a woman who understands basketball better than 99% of the population. And for anybody to give her shit because she has a vagina and not a penis makes me want to punch people.
Especially when you consider the resumes of some of the guys that are rolling out there to talk about these things. This is so far off topic. So DeAndre Daniels falls, twists his ankle, and he's sitting on the bench at Rutgers, and the trainer's working on him. All of a sudden, the ESPNU camera guy comes right up in his face, and he has the camera right in Daniels' face. You see Daniels look at the camera like, "Can I hit this guy?" like, what the fuck? And the trainer puts his hand right on the lens of the camera, like a paparazzi, you know, like a celebrity bodyguard pushing the paparazzi
well, I think
out.
It's because
the guy away.
I think it's because the rack is so shitty that
he's at the end of the bench.
That there's no space for the cameraman to maneuver. I'm like imagining that, like, they're in such a dump. Like, the announcers kept commenting on, well, we're in an unorthodox position tonight, commenting on this game.
That was funny. I didn't have very good access to volume, but I thought it was so funny. Every time the announcers came on, it looked like they were, like,
in the back alley,
like, next to
a
dumpster. Yeah.
They were in the
it's
tunnel.
Like a dimly lit brick wall behind them.
Yeah. And there's like fans walking by with beers in their hands. It was really funny.
I have a cool story.
Like, hey, can you get me some pretzels on the way back?
Yeah.
This goes back to our sort of journalistic responsibility, which I thought was really cool because this didn't need to happen. And I want to find the guy's name. He was the male announcer for ESPNU during that game. Adam Amin.
That's
so he responded. He said something like totally in passing during the game. Amada Brimo was having a very good first half. He had 10 points, probably like 6 rebounds. And Adam Amin, who was calling the game, said something like, well, Brimo's on pace for his second career double-double.
Right.
And I, you know, quickly pull up all the stats and I look because it didn't sound right. And, you know, us and Peter, who writes for the site, text a lot during the games. And we were calling bullshit on it, too.
Epic.
They're pretty great.
They're amazing.
So look at the stats, sure enough. In that great game he had against UCF, he scored 20 points, 8 rebounds. As Peter joked, it's his only single-double. Not only has he never recorded a double-double, that's the only time he's ever gotten either double-digit points or double-digit rebounds. He's never had double-digit rebounds.
Right.
So I text a correction saying, contrary to what ESPNU announcer says, he's never had a double-double before. This would be his first. So then I'm watching the game. The second half comes up, and I hear him go, oh, yeah, I should correct myself. Before I said it was going to be his second double-double, he's actually never had a double-double. So if he gets it, this will be his first. And I was thinking, oh, cool, you know, and then God help me, I make so many mistakes, and I have to correct myself sometimes at the behest of people screaming at me. And then so I open Twitter, And I have a message from him that says, hey, thanks for the Brima note. I had it written down 10 boards for that UCF game. I called that game. Ha ha. And I was like, so here's this guy. It's just scrolling Twitter, or probably more likely a ESPNU intern. Twitter searches ESPNU, you know, sees this statistical miscue, and he corrects it on air. And I was like, man, this is like the peak of internet journalism. This is like one where the, it should
one,
all meet.
One of the positives of Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all going to make mistakes. And, yeah. You know, I've done my fair share, and I'm sure we'll do our fair share again. Probably in this podcast. If you listen to the first part of this podcast, it's probably a shitload of mistakes. But I thought it was really cool, not only that he was willing to own up to these mistakes, but that he did it on air, and it was all, you know, thanks to Twitter that caught it.
And me as like a, you know, in my with my business background, to me, that's an excellent marketing tool.
Absolutely.
Because it makes the fan, feel that much more engaged because, oh, my God, the announcer...
And it made me like
responded
him more.
To me.
I'll be honest, when Seth Greenberg responded to us, like correcting him about how UConn is appropriately spelled, I was like, though his was a little like, oh, that my iPhone spells it wrong. And I was like, that's unacceptable, dude. Because it means you spelled it wrong at least one point.
I have no problem at all with Seth Greenberg, but I didn't buy that.
I don't know.
Seth Greenberg won me over after the Ali ejection when he said, that guy is a bad, on Twitter, he said, that guy's a bad ref.
He said, shout out to Seth Greenberg.
He said, total.
Shout out, Seth Greenberg.
So he said something like, he's a total diva. Yep. That guy's a bad ref.
Just for the record, capital U, capital C.
Yeah,
lowercase
O-N-N. It's not an acronym.
It is an abbreviation.
Humble brag, or not so humble brag, but I've been recognized several times as the pep band drummer.
Oh,
I thought you were
going to
say as the Husky.
Well,
aren't you Jonathan the Husky?
You were Jonathan the Husky.
I recognize you. You're
actually,
Jonathan the Husky.
I will say, alter ego. My proudest moment in college, and this is beyond anything academic that I did. But my proudest moment in college was when they put me in the Jonathan the Husky mascot uniform
and playing the drums,
and I played the fight song with the pep band on the drums, and I have a picture of it, and it's. You know, terrible resolution, but it's my most treasured picture. I love it.
Aww.
And
I'm sure your wife and kid will be happy to hear about this.
And it's a wonderful picture, but let me tell you something. There is nothing on the planet Earth that smells worse than the Jonathan the Husky uniform. It is absolutely putrid. It's like if like, I don't know if heaven and hell exist, but if hell exists, it's inside that suit.
Oh no!
Oh man!
Oh my God!
I don't
God.
Think they ever wash it.
Oh,
I think it's.
God.
I think
how
it's
would
just
you even wash that?
Every
sounds
sweaty
like a rite of passage
asshole,
at this point.
Like every sweaty asshole cheerleader that has ever been in there. Like it's like they did it out of spite.
But they seem so chipper when they're running around. Still, that takes some.
Because the perma smile on the dog's face.
Maybe that takes
inside
some composure.
Inside, they're like, I hate everything.
Yes, two people who participate in these podcasts have been drummers in the pep band. For
you,
for
sons
reference.
Of bitches. Got to go to the Madison Square Garden and
Final
to NCAA
four.
Tournament games, you bastards.
Final four.
Hate you.
That's a message out there to all prospective UConn students. The marching band and the pep band, it's not like a geeky thing. It's the most fun you could possibly have, seriously.
I will say if you work at the Daily Campus and you work your way up to that, you can also get to go to the games. Though I got to go to free concerts.
Yeah, but if they win the championship, you also get a ring.
Shut
do
up,
you
do you
as
really?
A, in the pep band?
Yes.
Oh.
Hold the phone. Yep. Did you actually get
I
a ring,
I had to
ring,
go on
Alex?
eBay and buy Ed Nelson's. That's a joke. It's a joke. Shout Ed Nelson.
I have lots of friends who have
rings. Damn it.
Yeah. On that note, thanks for tuning in to the A Dime Back podcast. A reminder, you can listen and subscribe to these on iTunes. Just go to adimeback.com and click the iTunes link under the podcast. And it'll give you the option to subscribe. Until then, we'll talk to you next time. Take it easy.